been moving steadily, though he had not opened his eyes. He was lying on the rear seat, fighting his emotions and losing badly. "Sure," he managed to say. He sat up and looked outside. They were on an interstate highway. A green sign flew by. Perry exit. They stopped in the parking lot of a pancake house less than a quarter of a mile from the interstate. Big trucks were in the distance, their diesel engines grinding along. Joel watched them for a second and listened. He glanced upward again and saw a half moon. "Are we in a hurry?" he asked Sizemore as they entered the restaurant. "We're on schedule," came the reply. They sat at a table near the front window with Joel looking out. He ordered French toast and fruit, nothing heavy because he was afraid his system was too accustomed to the gruel he'd been living on. Conversation was stiff. The two government boys were programmed to say little and were thoroughly incapable of small talk. Not that Joel wanted to hear anything they had to say. He tried not to smile. Sizemore would report later that Backman glanced occasionally at the door and seemed to keep a close eye on the other customers. He did not appear to be frightened. Quite the contrary. As the minutes dragged on and the shock wore off, he seemed to adjust quickly and became somewhat animated. He devoured two orders of French toast and had four cups of black coffee. A few minutes after 4 a.m., they entered the gates of Fort Summit near Brinkley, Texas. Backman was taken to the base hospital and examined by two physicians. Except for a head cold and the cough and general gauntness, he wasn't in bad shape. He was then taken to a hangar where he met a Colonel Gantner, who instantly became his best friend. At Gantner's instructions and under his close supervision, Joel changed into a green army jumpsuit with the name Herzog stenciled above the right pocket. "Is that me?" Joel asked, looking at the name.
"It is for the next 48 hours," Gantner said.
"And my rank?"
"Major."
"Not bad." At some point during this quick briefing, Mr. Sizemore from Washington and Agent Adair slipped away, never to be seen again by Joel Backman. With the first hint of sunlight, Joel stepped through the rear hatch of a C-130 cargo plane and followed Gantner to the upper level, to a small bunk room where six other soldiers were preparing for a long flight.
"Take that bunk," Gantner said, pointing to one close to the floor.
"Can I ask where we're going?" Joel whispered.
"You can ask, but I can't answer."
"Just curious."
"I'll brief you before we land."
"And when might that be?"
"In about 14 hours.
With no windows to distract him, Joel situated himself on his bunk, pulled a blanket over his head, and was snoring by takeoff. Chapter 3. Critz slept a few hours, then left home long before the inauguration mess began. Just after dawn, he and his wife were whisked off to London on one of his new employer's many private jets. He was to spend 2 weeks there, then return to the grind of the Beltway as a new lobbyist playing a very old game. He hated the idea. For years, he had watched the losers cross the street and start new careers twisting the arms of their former colleagues, selling their souls to anyone with enough money to buy whatever influence they advertised. It was such a rotten business. He was sick of the political life, but sadly, he knew nothing else. He'd make some speeches, maybe write a book, hang on for a few years hoping someone remembered him. But Critz knew how quickly the once powerful are forgotten in Washington. President Morgan and Director Maynard had agreed to sit on the Backman story for 24 hours until well after the inauguration. Morgan didn't care. He'd be in Barbados. Critz, however, did not feel bound by any agreement, especially one made with the likes of Teddy Maynard. After a long dinner with lots of wine, sometime around 2 a.m. in London, he called a White House correspondent for CBS and whispered the basics of the Backman pardon. As he predicted, CBS broke the story during its early morning gossip hour, and before 8 a.m., the news was roaring around D.C. Joel Backman had been given a full and unconditional pardon at the 11th hour.
There were no details of his release. When last heard from, he had been tucked away in a maximum security facility in Oklahoma. In a very nervous city, the day began with the pardon storming onto center stage and competing with a new president and his first full day in office. The bankrupt law firm of Pratt & Bowling now found itself on Massachusetts Avenue, 4 blocks north of DuPont Circle. Not a bad location, but not nearly as classy as the old place on New York Avenue. A few years earlier, when Joel Backman was in charge, it was Backman Pratt & Bowling then. He had insisted on paying the highest rent in town so he could stand at the vast windows of his vast office on the 8th floor and look down at the White House. Now the White House was nowhere in sight. There were no power offices with grand vistas. The building had 3 floors, not 8, and the firm had shrunk from 200 highly paid lawyers to about 30 struggling ones. The first bankruptcy, commonly referred to within the offices as Backman I, had decimated the firm, but it had also miraculously kept its partners out of prison. Backman II had been caused by 3 years of vicious infighting and suing among the survivors. The firm's competitors were fond of saying that Pratt & Bowling spent more time suing itself than those it was hired to sue. Early that morning, though, the competitors were quiet. Joel Backman was a free man. The broker was loose. Would he make a comeback? Was he returning to Washington? Was it all true? Surely not. Kim Bowling was currently locked away in alcohol rehab, and from there he would be sent straight to a private mental facility for many years. The unbearable strain of the last 6 years had driven him over the edge, to a point of no return. The task of dealing with the latest nightmare from Joel Backman fell into the rather large lap of Carl Pratt. It had been Pratt who had uttered the fateful "I do" 22 years earlier when Backman had proposed a marriage of their two small firms. It had been Pratt who had labored strenuously for 16 years to clean up behind Backman as the firm expanded and the fees poured in and all ethical boundaries were blurred beyond recognition. It had been Pratt who had fought weakly with his partner, but who over time had come to enjoy the fruits of their enormous success. And it had been Carl Pratt who had come so close to a federal prosecution himself, just before Joel Backman heroically took the fall for everyone. Backman's plea agreement and the agreement that exculpated the firm's other partners required a fine of $10 million, thus directly leading to the first bankruptcy, Backman I. But bankruptcy was better than jail, Pratt reminded himself almost daily. He lumbered around his sparse office early that morning, mumbling to himself and trying desperately to believe that the news was simply not true. He stood at his small window and gazed at the gray brick building next door and asked himself how it could happen. How could a broke, disbarred, disgraced former lawyer lobbyist convince a lame duck president to grant a last-minute pardon? By the time Joel Backman went to prison, he was probably the most famous white-collar criminal in America. Everybody wanted to see him hang from the gallows. But, Pratt conceded to himself, if anyone in the world could pull off such a miracle, it was Joel Backman. Pratt worked the phones for a few minutes, tapping into his extensive network of Washington gossip mongers and know-it-alls. An old friend who had somehow managed to survive in the executive department under 4 presidents, 2 from each party, finally confirmed the truth. "Where is he?" Pratt asked urgently, as if Backman might resurrect himself in D.C. at any moment. "No one knows," came the reply. Pratt locked his door and fought the urge to open the office bottle of vodka. He had been 49 years old when his partner was sent to prison for 20 years with no parole, and he often wondered what he would do when he was 69 and Backman got out. At that moment, Pratt felt as though he had been cheated out of 14 years. The courtroom had been so crowded that the judge postponed the hearing for 2 hours until the demand for seating could be organized and somewhat prioritized. Every prominent news organization in the country was screaming